Hello, it's Friday the 21st of May and a busy day on Radio 1. I'm Louise Herity, this is Playback Daily and here's just some of what's coming up.
Because we wanted to put the song out on a date that was kind of special and we, you know, wanted to not replace it, but you know, at this time of the year you'd be feeling down and sad just to kind of have something happier to think about, you know.
But over 80% of women in Ireland say they want to breastfeed, and yet on leaving the maternity ward, only 30% are breastfeeding. And by 6 months, which is what the World Health Organization recommends, 6% of Irish mothers are exclusively breastfeeding. We have the lowest rate in the EU, one of the lowest rates in the OECD.
It's sad, it's upsetting, it's not the result we wanted, but I think we did a fantastic job in doing something different and trying something different for Ireland.
Yeah.
14-year-old Michael Maloney went viral last year after he was surprised by Dermot Kennedy while performing on The Late Late Toy Show. Now the Mayo teen has released his own debut single dedicated to his late father. He spoke to Ryan Tubridy this morning.
Morning, how are you doing, Ryan?
It's funny because I see you described as Mikey in dispatches, but is your mother the only person who's allowed to call you that? Or like?
Well, it's kind of the family and friends who are always calling me Mikey, and then everyone else is kind of Michael, but I don't mind either one.
You're happy enough. You're one of the great superstars who broke out of the toy show this year when you were singing away for us. Before we talk about the Dermot Kennedy moment and everything like that, tell me, like, you applied for the toy show like everybody else, and what happens? Did they call you to say come in for an audition? Or, I mean, I have a rough idea, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, me and Mum kind of just, you know, sent in a video just for fun because we never really thought we'd get anywhere. You know, it's the toy show, you know, everybody auditions and, you know, we're from around the world this year. So we sent in an audition and we spent like 2 hours recording videos and re-recording it and like which song should we do. And we finally settled on, I think, Supermarket Flowers by Ed Sheeran.
Yeah,
and we just spent ages recording it and like going through each video and being like, well, actually, you know, I like this part in this video, but you know, this part in this other one isn't great. So we sent that in, and after a few weeks, they got back to us, and we weren't expecting this. And Mam just came out to me, and you know, she was just like, we were just over the moon with excitement. And you know, that's when they asked me to send in another video singing Giants. So I had actually never tried to sing that. You know, yeah. I love the song, but I never tried to sing it with guitar or anything. So they asked me to send in an audition on the Friday. And so I learned it over the weekend, trying to get it, you know, perfect as I could. Mm. And I sent it in on Sunday and kind of crossed my fingers. But, you know, we weren't, we definitely didn't think we'd get anywhere further than that. We were just, that was our claim to fame. You know, we got called back for a second audition for the toy show. And, you know, then one evening I just came home from school and my mum and my aunt were just sitting there talking, and they kind of just looked up to me and they were like, so any news, Michael? And, you know, they were just acting really suspiciously. And then they were just like, Michael, you're going to be on the toy show. And oh, to tell you that the excitement, you could have probably heard the screams in Dublin, to be honest.
Lovely. Lovely. I mean, it's so I'm delighted to hear that how exciting it all is. And then,
so
you got the nod, and then you come up, and we would have met that day before the show itself. Mm. And I knew from the moment I met you, you probably hated hearing this, but you can see good people from about 2 miles away, and you've got a good person's face. That sounds really strange, but you just seem like it. And I was right. You are a very, very good person.
Thank you so much.
No, I mean that. But you're so talented. And when you were performing, you were doing great. And when did you realise Dermot Kennedy was at your shoulder?
Well, I was singing the song, and my main thing was just go up there and have fun and don't forget the lyrics and come off. And I was the second verse, I think, and I heard Dermot Kennedy in the background, and I initially thought that his voice was a part of the backing track that I was singing along to.
Yeah.
But I thought it was like being turned up or something, because his voice was getting louder, obviously, because he was getting closer. And then you can probably see, but I like did a double take, and I looked over, and you know, Dermot Kennedy was there singing, and I kind of just forgot everything I was doing for like a split second. I was just like, what? You know, Dermot Kennedy is standing right there. It was the most magical moment of my life. But then I just had to remember, because I just had to remember to keep going and keep singing. And I was having so much fun as well. And after my mind had time to process what was going on, you know, I kind of was like, I'm singing with Dermot Kennedy on The Late Late Toy Show. And I just had to keep going. I was just having so much fun. And that is what I set out to do. So
yeah, and you achieved that. And he very kindly gifted you a guitar after the show. You told me about that like recently.
Oh, yeah, that was amazing. Because, you know, we met backstage, you know, with masks and social distancing and all. And he pointed into the corner to this guitar case.
Yeah.
And he gave it to me. And inside, I initially genuinely thought it was just a guitar case, which I was over the moon with anyway. But, you know, inside was this brilliant, brilliant left-handed Fender guitar. And it was signed and everything. Oh, it was the best night of my life. I'll never forget it.
Now, tell me about your dad, will you?
Yeah. Yeah. My dad was just, he was the best. We were best friends, you know. We went everywhere together. Like, if my dad had to go uptown, literally anywhere, if he had to go 5 minutes up to the shop to get milk or something, he'd always ask to bring me with him, and I'd always love to go. And, you know, he'd pick me up from school and he'd leave me to school, and, you know, I'd always get around him to go to the shop, and he'd always be getting me DVDs and magazines with the toys. And my favorite food at the time was chicken wings, and he always had to buy me those. And Mum, we'd come home and Mum, she'd be pretending, and she'd just be, you know, were you in the shop? And we'd be like, oh no, Daddy, were we in the shop? And Daddy'd be like, no. And, you know, there'd be orange just all over my mouth from the sauce from the chicken wings. And so, and everywhere we went, we were always just listening to music, whether that be in the car or, you know, even in the house. We have a jukebox in the front room filled with CDs. So we're just constantly listening to music, and it was just so much fun.
And he played himself, didn't he?
He didn't actually play anything.
I thought he played a guitar or something at some stage.
No, no.
Oh, my goodness.
He loved every type of music, you know. He was a Bob Dylan fanatic.
Oh, yes.
I think he went to see him 31 times in concert, if I think 34. Some mad number like that, because he travelled all of the United States and he went to see him any time he could. And he was like, he just loved Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen, and he just loved music, every type. Because he owned a rock music pub in Ballina, and so we'd always have gigs playing there, and, you know, so he just loved music.
And then he got ill.
Yeah. And it was devastating, you know. But, you know, 2 years he was ill for, and he put in a really, really terrible 2 years, and it wasn't great, you know, without going into any detail or anything, yeah. But, you know, it was devastating. It's like losing your best friend.
How old are you now?
I'm 14.
So you would have been 10 years old when your dad died?
Yeah, 10 years old.
10 years old at 59. What a horribly young, cruel thing to happen. And the anniversary is this week. Is that right, this weekend?
This Sunday, yeah. This Sunday is my dad's anniversary, because we wanted to put the song out on a date that was kind of special. And we, you know, wanted to not replace it. But, you know, at this time of the year, you'd be feeling down and sad, just to kind of have some happier to think about, you know.
And you wrote a song. Will you tell me about it?
Yeah. So, you know, after the toy show, Windmill kindly gifted me a voucher for the day in their studios. And I was trying to think, you know, what could I record or what could I do? And so, you know, I had some more songs written that I was going to record, and I was very happy to do so. But then one day I was sitting in the kitchen or something, and Mom was making breakfast, and it just kind of came to me like a light bulb moment, because my dad always, he was a chef as well, so he used to always make me breakfast in the same pan. And I was just thinking back, and I just had the thought, you know, why don't I write a song for my dad? So I had that kind of thought in my head, and I sat with it for a while, and I thought, you know, what angle could I come at it from? How could I write this song? So I kind of thought metaphors, you know, because I didn't really want it to be a literal kind of sense of play-by-play of what happened. Because I wanted people to kind of be able to listen to it and kind of relate to it in their own way and with their own story. So I asked Mum what she thought, and she gave me the idea of weather metaphors. So I sat down at the table and I made a list of all the weather terms I could think of, you know, rainbows, fog, hot, cold, you know, all these terms. And I kind of mixed them in with what happened. So even for the lyric, you know, I woke up and you were gone. You know, it's just kind of what happened. I woke up and Mum had just told me that Dad was gone. So mm-hmm. It's kind of a play-by-play of what happened, but with some metaphors in there so people can relate to their own story.
The song is very beautiful, Michael.
Thank you so much.
It's really beautiful, and I'm glad that it's a single. I'm glad that it's released today. I'm glad that you're going to perform it for us on the Late Late Show tonight.
Oh, I'm so excited.
I'm really excited to see you again and to hear you perform this song so close to the anniversary. And how's your mum doing?
Mum's good as well. We're kind of, you know, getting through it, and we've been really excited about the song, so that's kept us well occupied for the last two and a half months or so. It's just been such a buzz and so much fun.
Now, we want to kind of keep the exclusive of the song for the Late Late Show tonight, but we can steal a little clip of it now. Will we do that just to give people a sneak preview? Okay, this is your gorgeous
brilliant
song.
Thank you so much. This
is thunder in the clouds, there's a chill in the air. I try my best to share my despair. The fog blurs my view, but you got my way.
Honest to God, Michael, you've got some voice. You know that?
Thank
you really
so
do. Here's some text coming in. Michael, your song is just amazing. You're a legend. Such a meaningful, well-written and performed song. We were in floods of tears listening to Spotify at 12 a.m. So we are so proud of you. Emmett must be the proudest dad in heaven right now and sending love to Mum Sandra, your right-hand woman, with you all the way on this amazing journey from the Armstrong, Ballina and the Butler family in Knockmore. So they're all thinking of you. Nolene and Carlos says, delighted for Michael's success. Lovely to hear his voice again. So talented. He handled Dermot Kennedy's appearance so well for such a young person. He's gorgeous in personality and looks too. He'll be famous worldwide yet, either in a solo capacity or in a big stunners boy band. Thinking of him for his dad's anniversary on Sunday. Fond regards to him. Ramona in Drumcondra says, could you let Michael know that my three young children love him? They love Dermot's song, but since the toy show, it's Michael's version that we listen to. And his dad is smiling down on him for sure. So you really did steal a lot of hearts in this country when it all happened.
I'm blown away with all the nice comments and everything. And people are just so kind. And that's really just been the best part of it all. Just seeing like how kind everybody is. It's just been amazing.
You earned it. You earned it yourself. So well done. See you later, pal.
See ya.
All right. Best for now. Best to your mum as well. Okay, Michael Maloney.
And if you miss Michael's performance on tonight's Late Late Show, you can watch it back on the RTE Player. On Today with Claire Byrne, the host spoke to John O'Mara from Tipperary, whose partner of 20 years, Michelle Beattie, sadly passed away in January after contracting COVID-19. The couple have three children together, and because they were cohabiting and not married, John is not entitled to benefits that a widower would get.
John joins me now, along with Damien Pilo, who's CEO of TROR, the information service for unmarried parents. Good morning, John. Thank you for joining us. You've had a very tough time of it.
Good morning, Claire. Yeah, Claire, look, it's been, I just can't describe really, Claire, how it's been. You know, it's been very traumatic. Not to lose the person you've lived with and built a family with over the last 20 years, you know, it's just not easy.
Yeah, and such circumstances as well. I know Michelle had cancer, but she was doing well, was she?
She was doing well, yeah. She only had scans and checkups on last November, and you know they were all good, and she was actually quite happy. You know, we were looking good. We were hoping this is behind us. You know.
Mm-hmm. And then when did she become ill with COVID?
She fell ill on December the 18th. She went into the A&E in University Hospital Limerick, and They told her that she had COVID. So she was there then. She was actually released on the 23rd of December and came home, and she was self-quarantined. And on Christmas Day, she was quite ill. And on Stephen's morning, I had to call the ambulance, and they took her back in. And she ended up in the high dependency unit.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, she ended up in ICU. And eventually ended up in an induced coma on a ventilator. And, you know, to be fair, like, they were amazing. They tried everything they could. But, like, she fought an amazing battle, like, but it just, you know, it just wasn't to be, like, she was just hard, you know.
And so she died on the 31st of January, as I said.
Yeah, she died on the 31st of January. You know, we got the kids in to say goodbye. And, you know, it's just some of the hardest things you'll ever have to do, you know. But eventually, like, you know, you're just trying to figure out how you're dealing with these things as you go along after, you know, then that's the hard thing.
My heart goes out to you, John, to you and the three children. I mean, such a dreadful thing to happen at such a dreadful time as well, with all of the restrictions in place and so on. But what you want to talk about today is about the situation that you have been left in now, because you weren't married together for 20 years, and that has left you with huge problems now.
Yeah, sure. I was self-employed, and you know, Michelle had worked all her life in the IB, and like, basically, for me to go back to work, I'm going to go back to work. Like, the only payments that are available to me, like, are job seekers payments and things like that, and they're not even adequate, because like the one that's offered to me at the moment, like, would be gone when my youngest child reaches 14. Like, Tommy's 10, like, going on 11, and like, these are just totally inadequate payments. But like, had we been married, like, and I'd be offered the widower's pension now, like, which, like, that's on means tested, and would offer me, just over 330 euros a week, and allow me to back to work. You know, and like, I don't understand what the difference is between someone like who cohabits or marries, both people having paid their contributions all their lives. Like, it shouldn't make any difference.
And you'd be entitled to a grant as well, wouldn't you, if you had been married?
Yes. I'd be entitled to, like, the bereavement grant, you know. It's 8,000 euros.
Yeah, you see, all of those things, they allow you to look after your children when they need you, don't they?
Yeah, that's essentially it. I have to go to work. I have to go back to work and provide for my family, as we always did. But, like, you just need that little bit of assistance, because, like, there is only one payment that is, you know, designed for someone in my situation, and that is a widower's pension.
Yeah. And you went and you sought help and you sought advice and you appealed all of these decisions and you got nowhere, is that right?
No, there's nothing available. You see, the big problem here is, like, the family is only recognised in Ireland, in the state, as a married couple only. You know, and like, that's big, like, because, like, when I looked into this, like, there's near 300,000 families in Ireland, like, that are not recognised by the state. You know, and their children are being discriminated against in many ways. And, like, to be afforded different payments and benefits and help because of your marital status, like, just doesn't make any sense to me.
Mm-hmm. And you did try, is that right, towards the end, to organise a marriage ceremony?
We did, yeah, we did. We went to great lengths to try and organise that. Like, you know, like, the staff in the hospital tried to, they've tried everything, like, to just get Michelle even back out of her coma, just to, you know, that we could actually manage to do this in the hospital. Even we spoke about this last year, but obviously due to COVID, you know, things weren't going to happen. So we didn't think things were going to just happen as they did, you know.
Mm-hmm. Damien, can I bring you in here? I mean, what can John do, or how common is this problem?
Good morning, Claire. Yes, this is unfortunately something that Tror hears about all too often. And John is right. It stems from our constitution and the fact that the state recognises the family as the fundamental group in society, but that family is based on marriage, and therefore, by implication, the non-marital family is not recognised, and that creates huge difficulties for John and many, many people like John. And what's really at the heart of this is that John and Michelle's relationship is as legitimate, and their concern and care for each other and their children is as legitimate as anybody else's. And yet they, you know, because they didn't have that marriage contract and that marriage certificate, they then are struggling in relation to the supports that are needed for the family after the death of one of the parents.
But this is clearly, Damien, an anomaly, because if you are living together with somebody, you're jointly assessed for revenue purposes.
Yeah, absolutely. And if it was just an anomaly, we would be able to resolve it much quicker. It's because it stems from the constitution, and it's shifting those historic cultural attitudes towards the the unmarried family, and we've done a lot in this country to do that. I mean, we've had huge changes in legislation, but we still haven't gone far enough. And you're right, in terms of John applying for Department of Social Protection, any means test, they will be assessed as a joint couple, regardless of their marital status, except when it comes to this grant, and he's not entitled to it. In revenue, they're treated as individuals when they go to revenue, and they weren't treated as cohabitants, so they can't claim tax credits. If one of them stays at home to look after the children, the other one can't claim tax credits. There's lots of things we can do to make the situation for couples who are in intimate, committed relationships to make their lives better, you know, and make it better for their children, because we passed the Children and Family Relationships Act. We passed the referendum on children to put children at the heart of decisions, and this is affecting John, and as you rightly said, Claire, his children, to the protection of the grant and the widow's pension that should be afforded to him and his family.
And Damien, couples can follow a legal path to take care of things like home ownership, guardianship of the children, but your point is they shouldn't have to go down this route, because cohabiting couples, you say, should have the same entitlements as married couples or those couples who are in a civil partnership recognised by the state.
Yeah, and we can make, I mean, I saw the Minister, Simon Harris, was talking about the need for a referendum to better define the family, and I hope when he's talking about that, he's talking about all family types, you know, and it's really important that we consider the family as every different type of families in Ireland, because we now know that we have so many different types of families, blended families, families from previous marriages, people living together, we have so much more, and John's talked about his family situation. And yes, there's legal redress through the redress schemes for certain aspects, but they can be very difficult and very time consuming and very challenging for families to access, and legally expensive. So we need to find better ways to protect the children's right to have that protection after the death of one of their parents, or both of those parents. And so, you know, it's hugely important. And the bigger thing here is, Claire, that there was a case taken by a woman in the north of Ireland, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court for the widow's grant, and she won it on appeal through the Supreme Court, that the widow grant should have been, in very similar circumstances to John, that it would have been, she should have been afforded that opportunity for the widow's grant.
Yes.
And so the state is open to the similar challenge by somebody like John going all that way. But why should we have to? Why should he have to, you know, do that and take on the state in relation to? I don't think anybody would be trying to argue against his right to that grant.
But John, what do you think about that? I mean, I know the Labour Party leader, Alan Kelly, raised your situation in the Dáil, but would you consider a legal challenge?
I would consider it, Claire, but I don't feel as though it's something I should have to do, like, at this day and age. You know, like, it's blatantly plain to be seen that, like, it's totally inadequate. Like, everything that they have to support people nowadays is inadequate due to the Constitution, you know. Things just need to be changed. I think everybody across government is of the opinion that this is wrong. And they just need to sit back and just figure out a way of doing this. And there is ways of doing this, you know. Like,
there's the financial implication, which is clear, right? But then I would imagine for you, and tell me if I'm wrong, do you feel like the state, your country, is questioning the validity of your relationship, the life that you lived with Michelle, and the relationship that you and your children have, your family unit?
It's one of the biggest issues I have here, Claire, with this, is that, because, like Michelle lived for her family, and, like, to know afterwards, like, that we were never recognised as a family by the state. And like, there's 300,000 families not recognised by the state. They're in the, like, what, you shouldn't be made feel any different, regardless of your marital status.
We asked the Department of Social Protection about this, and they've sent us a statement. Now, it is lengthy, so bear with me. I'll take out of it what I can. The legal context, they say, governing life partnership relationships such as marriage is set out in various civil partnership, marriage and family law acts. Entering into a marriage or civil partnership is a legal act which confers both rights and obligations on both parties that do not exist in law between cohabiting couples. The statement then goes on. The core requirement is that there must have been a legally recognised relationship conferring mutual rights and obligations between the bereaved person and the person who is deceased. This relationship is not dependent on the people involved sharing the same household or on any other aspect of their living arrangements. Equally, the fact that two people share a household is not of itself sufficient to establish the legal relationship of a civil partnership or marriage, and in the absence of this legal relationship, the department cannot award a payment. Now, I'll go on to what it says at the end. The department understands and is sympathetic to the position of people who lose a much loved life partner, including those who do not have the formal legal status of life partner. For that reason, the department would encourage people in long-term relationships and who are concerned to protect the interests of their life partners in the event of their deaths to formalise that relationship through marriage or civil partnership. So, Damien, that seems to be advice there. They're saying that it's a legally recognised situation when you're once you're in a civil partnership or a marriage. Beyond that, what they're saying is that you should do that. You should formalise your relationship.
Well, look, Irish society has dramatically changed, as we all know. And, you know, the statistics are showing us that more and more births have been born outside of marriage year on year. Currently up around 39% of all births are outside of marriage. So we know that people are making choices about about marriage and for many, many reasons people don't get married and choose not to get married. And yet they've been penalised. So there's a legal recognition by the Department of Social Protection of children, of families, when they assess them and jointly when they're means testing them, when they're living and cohabiting together. So they seem to be picking and choosing there. So on one hand, they will legally recognise that relationship, and another time when it comes to something like the widow's pension or the widow's grant, yeah, they won't.
To be fair, though, Damien, they say changing social welfare law to provide for a survivor payment in circumstances where there was no legally recognised civil partnership or marriage would be very challenging. And they explained that it would need to take account of the varied nature of relationships that might exist between people sharing a household, including in households where there were more than two cohabitants. So I suppose what they're saying there is it could be open to abuse.
Yeah, it could. But, I mean, there's well-established guidelines for how they assess, you know, cohabiting couples, you know, and they talk about them living together in an intimate, committed relationship, and so how they assess that for the joint applications for means testing is there already, so they do it. It is complex, Claire. There's no one saying it isn't, but
yes,
there's a will
you're
to try
it's
and amend
fixable.
It. Yeah, it's very possible. We've done incredible things in relation to donor-assisted reproduction and ensuring that, you know, children have access to information and birth certs can go on the names of parents that are the non-biological parent go on a birth cert to be automatically a guardian straight after the birth of a baby. You know, they were huge, complex things that had legal ramifications for how we identify the family. So we can do it when there's a will.
Okay.
And we need to do it now for the thousands of people that are, the hundreds of thousands of people that are in these situations.
Indeed. And John, you're not alone because we're already hearing from people who are in a similar situation. So just to be clear, will you just tell us exactly what your call is today before we finish?
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to point out there what you just said before I go as well, that like the Department of Finance are, They recognise when someone gets deemed as a qualified cohabitant by the court for financial purposes in this day, like in wills and things like that. So they have no problem. Revenue have no problem accepting a qualified cohabitant.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so, you know, look, my whole thing here is before I go, look, and like I've sent a letter to the Taoiseach. He invited me to send him a letter. And it's basically I'm calling for something to be done to rectify the wrongs that are done. And if they do it, like there's so many, there's thousands and thousands of people like me who are going to be left because, like as he stated, it can't be done retrospectively, and we could be just left in the loophole. And like we need some sort of guarantee that we will be helped as well. Like, and we're living in a different society now than the one of 1930. You know, we need to move with the times.
John O'Mara speaking to Claire Byrne. Well, this Monday, Bob Dylan turns 80, and on Morning Ireland, Cian McCormack reported on his legacy and how his music, words and artistry, reframed songwriting, remain culturally relevant and permeate our world.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man?
Some call him the voice of a generation.
How many seas must the white dove sail?
Here's Bob Dylan's take on that.
I think that was just a term that can create problems for somebody, especially if someone just wants to keep it simple and write songs and play them.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
This was part of a 2004 interview with NPR, National Public Radio, in the United States.
Having these colossal accolades and titles, they get in the way.
Born on May 24th, 1941, in Duluth, Minnesota, Robert Allen Zimmerman came to prominence in the 1960s.
And it's hard, it's hard.
His songs were anthems for the civil rights and anti-war movements.
And you know, at a time of very great social protest, this was the guy, because for young people there was a place for an artist to communicate something that was different than everybody else, and Bob Dylan was the man. I'm talking here early and mid-60s.
RTÉ's Dave Fanning says Bob Dylan's place in music history is rivaled only by the Beatles.
Once upon a time you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime.
There was great, as they say, social protest, huge changes in music, and he was the one who was the front of it all, and he brought it right through into the 70s and 80s. And I must say, like, if there's one person I have to look to in terms of the greatest of all in rock, I'd look to Bob Dylan, in the same way, as I say, that his importance is rivaled only by the Beatles.
Just like Dave Fanning, RTÉ Lyric FM's John Kelly is a Dylan fan.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me.
The first time I heard him was possibly Mr. Tambourine Man on the radio, but it really, when I heard him properly, was when I was a teenager and I got my hands on, I think it was Bringing It All Back Home. And I thought, here's a world I can get into.
John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on a pavement thinking about the government. The man in a tree.
For John Kelly, when you talk about Bob Dylan, you have to look back to his folk days, and more importantly, his ability to retain, access and use what he heard, read and experienced.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam.
He went in there to that folk scene and learned a whole lot and took it with him. And he seems to have this extraordinary mental capacity to remember everything that he hears, everything that he reads. He seems to be able to access it. He seems to be able to go and get it whenever he needs it and use it and play with it and then add his own thing to it and invent something of his own.
Anne Powers, an NPR music critic and a contributor to a new anthology called The World of Bob Dylan, says Dylan reframed songwriting.
He connected the historical expansiveness of the folk tradition, the daring avant-gardism of the Beats, and the attitude, the sexiness, the constant need for renewal and novelty of rock and roll. And in making those connections, he did change the game for every songwriter who came after him.
In 2016, this happened.
Nobelpriset I litteratur, år 2016, tilldelas Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature
for having created new poetic expressions within the great American song tradition.
Poet Katrina O'Reilly.
The citation making reference to the great American song tradition is in a part a nod to that tradition as well as a recognition of Dylan's individual achievement.
Anne Powers says Dylan's words are culturally relevant and permeate our world.
Young people who don't even know who Bob Dylan is as a person know his songs, even if they don't know the reference they're hearing is from one of his songs. And to me, that is how a culturally relevant writer is defined. His work has permeated our world. It's about, is that work in our lifeblood? And I think it is when it comes to Bob Dylan.
As he turns 80, what's Bob Dylan's legacy? Again, Katrina O'Reilly.
Probably an important aspect of his legacy is highlighted by material he released last year. And one of those songs is called Murder Most Foul.
It was a dark day in Dallas, November 63.
And it referenced the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963. And it then segues from that into a kind of litany of his own cultural reference points. And I think what he's doing there is making a plea for the importance of art and popular art, and saying that it has something to say and it has a serious social impact and that it matters. And I think that that's what Dylan's legacy ultimately will be.
I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
And that was Cian McCormack's report for Morning Ireland. On Today with Claire Byrne, Claire was joined by Dr. Avi Ní Chulainn, who spoke about why the rates of breastfeeding in Ireland are still so low and what we need to do to support new mothers.
Breastfeeding support was given a boost recently, with funding to the tune of 1.58 million to be spent on much needed lactation consultant posts in maternity hospitals. But on the 40th anniversary of the signing of the World Health Organization's International Code of Marketing of Breast Milk Substitutes, the question is, are we doing enough to support women and their families to make decisions on how best to feed their babies? Well, Avi Ní Chulainn is a mother, a member of the Baby Feeding Law Group Ireland, and the mother representative on the National Maternity Hospital Infant Feeding Steering Committee, and she's here.
Hi, good morning, Claire.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
You had one child the last time we spoke.
Yeah.
Now you have two children.
Now I have two.
How's all that going for you?
Wonderful. It's a very different experience having a baby in the pandemic than it was before that. And my heart absolutely goes out to anybody who has given birth or been pregnant during the pandemic, because it's a totally different experience. Your labour is totally different. Your post-birth experience, where you have literally no supports around you. I find it so different. And that's actually what got me into this, Claire, like advocating for breastfeeding supports, because in my area, the one thing we had as new mothers was an online group from our public lactation consultant. I found out later there's only four public lactation consultants in the whole country, and she was redeployed. And I just thought, this is horrific. Mm-hmm. Like, mothers have so little help at the minute. You can't even have someone really in to help you with the new baby, things like that. If you've had a C-section, all of that, and that support was getting taken away. So this got me looking at breastfeeding in general across the country.
So tell me a little bit about how the public lactation consultant worked. So if you had a problem, a question, that person is there?
They're there. Yeah. Same as you could call your public health nurse. This person was just there to give you assistance with your breastfeeding. And I didn't know they existed, as I said. Most mothers would go to a private lactation consultant. Bonubaha did a report and they found that on average, women are spending €450 if they're going to a private lactation consultant for those consultancies. And obviously, not everybody can afford that. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't go to a private lactation consultant because my thing was, well, if I can't do it myself, I won't do it at all. And that's another, like, it's a very negative way of thinking about breastfeeding, because it can be difficult. Both my babies had tongue tie. I absolutely needed someone to diagnose it and someone to help me with the latching and all that kind of stuff. The baby does as well, because they need to relearn if you get the tongue tie fixed. My second boy had a tooth, so I really needed my public
born
lactation.
Born with a tooth?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So I needed the help from her to tell me how to deal with this. And it should be
I really
something...
admire you for pushing through all of that. You know, because that's really difficult.
Oh,
and you're
God,
so
it was,
tired. You
it
say,
was
I'm
difficult.
Just, it's really tempting to say, I'm just not doing this.
Yeah, and thankfully, you know, I have a very supportive husband, and I really wanted to breastfeed. My mother had breastfed all of us. It's something I really wanted to do. But over 80% of women in Ireland say they want to breastfeed, and yet on leaving the maternity ward, only 30% are breastfeeding. And by 6 months, which is what the World Health Organization recommends, 6% of Irish mothers are exclusively breastfeeding. We have the lowest rate in the EU, one of the lowest rates in the OECD. This is a big problem in this country.
Tell me why that is.
Well, two prongs. I mean, there's two elements to it. One, we're not supporting mothers enough. We don't have enough midwives on the wards. They don't have time to sit with the mother. 10 minutes would probably, you know, give you enough support to say, we need your milk to come in. This is how you would latch, you know, let the baby, you know, be beside you and suckle whenever they want, all of those kinds of things. So we need supports. We need less influence from the big food companies who are pushing formulas all of the time. So what I am advocating for is first the implementation of the breastfeeding strategy, which we have a wonderful strategy. I read it again last night. And if we put all that into place, our breastfeeding rates would improve. As you said, they're going to put money into more lactation consultants. Great. Get them in as soon as possible. put that plan into implementation. And the second thing is the WHO has been asking us for 4 decades to curtail the advertising of these big food companies, these formula companies or breast milk substitute companies. 4 decades, and we haven't legislated for it. Mm-hmm. And you might think, you know, well, what's the big deal? And I did think, what's the big deal? But if advertising was just about information, it wouldn't be a big deal. But advertising is actually making us feel that we need something that we previously didn't need. And something very cynical, if I can tell you this, Claire, because I didn't know this. There's no such thing as a follow-on milk. You don't need it.
So I was just trying to think of the ads that I have seen. Yeah. And I have seen ads for follow-on milk, mm-hmm. not for milk from birth. So are they advertising that? Are they allowed?
So they're not allowed to advertise milk from birth from mm-hmm. 0 to 6 months.
Formula milk, we should say, yeah.
Yeah, formula. And what they have done is they created a product which is follow-on milk, or Formula 2, you might know it as.
Yeah.
And they literally only created that to get around the advertising restrictions. So actually what we really should be doing is just giving our babies the Formula 1 milk. If you decide to feed your baby with formula, Formula 1 milk all the way through until they're 12 months, and then just give them regular milk. But they've also now created Formula 3 milk for your toddler, which it's actually not good for your children, because the Formula 2 and Formula 3 have more sugar in them. And you really shouldn't be doing that.
So
but they created
ideally
them.
Ideally then, you're breastfeeding your baby until they're 6 months old.
Ideally.
You may decide to carry on beyond that.
You may
that.
Decide, yeah. But you may not be able to. And this is the other thing about the code, Claire, because the code is only about marketing and advertising. The code recognises that these big food companies are in for profit, they're not in it for public health. So the code is only there to protect families in whatever way they want to feed their children. But if 100% of babies were fed formula milk, this code would be even more important, because we don't want the companies who have the most money to put into advertising to be winning in the game. You don't need to have these things advertised to you. Like, I buy loads of stuff in the supermarket that doesn't have a television ad or doesn't have a social media ad.
Yes.
We should be asking our healthcare professionals about what formula to give. And I give my baby formula. I couldn't feed him after 16 weeks with the tooth and everything like that. So I'm not giving out to any mothers. Mothers have enough to do mm-hmm. rather than feel ashamed.
Well, that's the thing about having this conversation.
Yeah.
You know, some people do feel very ashamed mm-hmm. and they do feel very pressurized, and it can be very emotional.
Oh, it can.
This conversation.
And this is why I go back to my first point. We need more supports in the very beginning. Giving a leaflet to a mother to say breastfeeding is best is not actually any help at all. Spending 10 minutes with her when she's given birth, talking to her, how do you want to feed your baby? This is entirely your decision. If you want to breastfeed, let me spend some time with you and we'll go through the process, because you need to learn this, the baby needs to learn this. Mm-hmm. If every mother had that, our rates would go up, because if we take Norway, for example, 80% of their hospitals are breastfeeding friendly, according to the WHO. And their rates are 80% of babies are breastfed at 6 months solely. And they go on to doing that for a year. Now, they also have wonderful maternity leave, but it's because the hospitals are baby friendly, they're breastfeeding friendly. So if we had that by implementing our breastfeeding strategy plan, we would be able to increase those numbers. So women want to do this. They're just not being given the right
help.
So
why has the strategy not been implemented?
Well, I mean, that's a big question, Claire. I don't know if there's political will around it at the minute, and probably because the people who were shouting about it are mothers who are tired and they have enough to do, and they're probably volunteering on other groups and other things like that. So there needs to be political will implementing the breastfeeding plan, but there also needs to be political will to curb the big companies who are subtly giving us this environment to say, like, you know, the formula is as good as breast milk, and you know, you might need to top up, and if you give this to your baby, they'll be wonderfully athletic and great at, you know, calculations and things like that. Like, I'm just thinking about the ads I've seen on television. Do you know, there are all these subtle messages, and the marketing worked. This is why our breastfeeding rates fell. You know, back at the beginning of the century, we had over 90% of babies breastfed in Ireland. That dropped off up into the Second World War, and this was worldwide because the formula companies had convinced everybody that the formula was more scientific and mm-hmm. better than breast milk. Mm-hmm. So the marketing won out.
Yeah,
so we need to curb that.
At the same time, if there is a mother listening to this who is feeding their baby with formula, I do not want you to feel or upset.
And
you know,
I don't either.
And I know you don't either.
Yeah, because, you know, we need formula, and I'm not saying we don't need formula, but we need families not to feel pressured to buy a certain formula or to continue buying a certain formula. Like the companies themselves, they want to get first-time mothers because they want your brand familiarity.
The loyalty.
You'll stick with that.
Okay, so if women are looking for advice now without this strategy being in place and all of the other things you said need to be done, what do they do? Where do they go?
Well, check your area. Hopefully there might be a public lactation consultant. If there isn't, get onto your local TD and ask why there isn't a lactation consultant in your area. But you can go to the volunteer groups like La Leche League and Quidju. We just shouldn't be depending on those volunteer groups. The government should be doing this. And I think we've had a century now of the state prioritising institutions and industries over mothers and babies. And I think it's time now that mothers and babies need to be prioritised because this is a public health issue.
And also the public health nurse will help you out as well. And
she will, she
there,
will.
There may be a breastfeeding group in your area that you can go to online at the moment, most probably, for a bit of advice. Evie, it's lovely to see you. Thank you,
you
very
too,
much
Claire.
For coming
Thank
in.
Thank you.
Evie Nihulavon speaking to Claire Byrne. It was another year of disappointment for the Irish at the Eurovision Song Contest when we failed to make it out of the semi-finals. And Ray Darcy spoke to the Irish entrant Leslie Roy, who's still in Rotterdam ahead of tomorrow night's final.
Because a lot of people have said since Tuesday night that when you actually came out from behind the props, that's when you shone.
Yeah, we know, I think that was built into it, is that we wanted to have a big revealing moment and that to feel special, to leave that kind of little world that I journey through. But look, it, genuinely, like in hindsight, I'm still glad that we did try and do something different. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, maybe it wasn't exactly Eurovision-y enough, but I think people will be trying to, you know, do prospective performances in the coming years after seeing what we were trying to do.
I was saying, and this is just me thinking, that over the last number of years that the CGI and the green screen and all that has gone as far as it can go. And I was thinking that that's what she decided to do, go back to basics, that it was sort of old school animation. That's the way it used to be done before computers existed.
Exactly.
Was that the thinking? That was the thinking.
Was I think we had a whole year, like you said, on Zoom calls and on our phones and online. And, you know, I have kind of gotten to a place where I didn't want to do the full mad explosion pyro lights on the stage for the night. I wanted to try and do something that was really built for television and for people at home. You know, when we built this, we didn't think there was going to be anybody in the audience either.
Uh-huh.
So it was really, really geared towards television, and I wanted it to have a bit more texture and something that almost felt tangible for people to kind of grab onto sitting, you know, on the couches and move away from the lights.
So it was all moving parts then?
It was, yeah. They were all parts that were hand moved, yeah.
Right, okay. And it involved a lot, it demanded a lot of you, I think, to know when to press something or hit something or hit a mark and be at a certain place at a certain time, did it?
Markers, but again, I mean, if you look at any of the other girls' choreography, it's not much different than moving from X, Y, Z in a dance routine.
Yeah. So Fredrik Reidman is the man you were talking about, and he did Norway's winning entry a number of years ago.
Sweden.
And people would remember that the guy sat down on a bench, and then there was a stick man beside him, which was computer generated, and then he flew off with his balloon, and it was a lovely, cute. A lovely use of the technology, not overused. He knows what he's doing.
100%.
And was that your choice or RTE's choice, or who chose him?
That's a group choice. You know, I went and I sent the song to Frederick, and he loved it. And I went back to RTE, and we all came up with this staging together, you know, over many, many Zoom calls. Yeah. The three of us sat down, Frederick and Michael and I, and we really tried to do something creative and different.
Yeah. The song, like I played the song in its entirety there on Wednesday, and it struck me again, not that I needed to be struck, but that it's a really good song. The song's really good, and you're a really good singer. You know, so all those elements were there. There was no debate about that. And then I was watching at home with my wife Jenny and the two kids, and it was supposed to come to Ireland, and then there was a stop or something, and the presenter looked a little bit frazzled. So what was going on when we were watching that? What was going on in your world?
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of more confusing and upsetting part, but it's not the blame of why we didn't get into the final, but it is confusing that I was standing on the stage and their camera broke. And that, you know, we'd run that rehearsal for the past 2 weeks and there was no issues. You know, our props didn't break. Nothing that we brought broke. And there was people running on the stage and I had no idea what was happening. Nobody told me. And then the track started and I just had to go into it. So I didn't know if actually anything was going to work or what was going to happen throughout the song.
Okay.
So that is what happened on the technical side of it.
Yes.
But it wasn't on our technical side, but if that makes sense.
That's not good. You know, even your description of it there has increased my heart rate. So I can't. No, honestly, now I'm not messing with you here. So I can only imagine what happened to you.
Well, live television,
yes,
though, there you have to kind of factor in technical or human error, and it just so happened for our performance, you know. And again, there's no blame on the EBU.
No,
it did happen, so it's just kind of to take it forward next year, and hopefully that doesn't happen to Ireland, you know, in the Eurovision next year.
So you were standing there and nobody was communicating to you. All you could see was people running here, there and everywhere with wires and cameras and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then without a cue to you, the music started.
Yeah, then,
right,
you know, they gave a
You're
thumbs
back in track.
That, yeah, the track started. But, you know, that wasn't how we rehearsed it or
no.
how any other country rehearsed their performance. But
yeah.
You look, again, live TV.
I know, but you're on the back foot then, you know. And, You're not going to tell me, unless you're superhuman, that your heart rate didn't increase when all that was going on.
I mean, I don't know. We'd run it so many times that once you hear those strings, ready to go. But, you know, think with that being said, it was a great performance.
Yeah.
And I literally did everything I possibly could do for this entry.
Yeah. And you would do it the same again, given the opportunity?
Given the opportunity, yeah. I mean, I think I'd look at how artistic I'd take it. but I think I'm definitely, I've no bother handing over the hat now for someone else next year.
Okay, and what advice would you give them?
Do your best. I mean, advice to anybody, do your best, put your heart and soul into it. And, you know, I tried to be as honest too, and that's what came out from my staging, and people got it and some people didn't get it.
Did you watch last night's semi-final?
Yeah, we had it on, yeah.
Yeah. I thought you would have come through out of that. I know that's ifs and buts and all that sort of thing. And you must, as a singer and a songwriter, look at some of those acts and go, ah, come on.
I mean, but again, that's the Eurovision, you know, and I think we've been watching it go like this for the past 10, 12 years, and some of the finals are harder than others. And, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, like I've described them, and maybe it's not fair. Like three bad, or even four bad Beyoncés got through. You know,
but those are your words now, not mine.
But no, and I'm wondering as well, because I know there was a new rule this year where you could include backing vocals on the backing track. That seems to have changed things as well, or am I imagining things?
I mean, I think it was good that they included that because, again, they didn't know who could fly how many people could be there. So you could include some harmonies on the backing track and have live vocals as well. So I guess we'll see on the final how many different vocals is on the winning performance. But I think it was good that they did try and do that.
Because there was one guy last night and his microphone was down near the floor and I could still hear him.
right, because of the backing vocals. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Because I suppose, what's the definition of backing vocals? When they do become lead vocals and blah, 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 you know? So, you know that you featured on Liveline quite a lot. Did you hear any of that?
Oh, yeah, I didn't catch the show.
You didn't catch the show, yeah. I think you understand this because you're a fan of the Eurovision and you know Ireland, in that it's one of those things that everybody has an opinion on and they get very emotional about, but then they forget about it 2 days later. And that's the thing about the Eurovision. Unfortunately, that's not the case for you. So what's next for you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've been writing songs for years for myself, for other artists, and I've got a bunch of projects now, I think, that'll be propping up. And from some of the messages I read online, a few offers all over the place for different things when shows can, you know, open up again to perform. And I can't wait to get home to Ireland and actually, you know, perform in an open concert to the fans that loved Maps and loved Story My Life. So I'm looking forward to that.
And are you relocating from New York to Dublin?
I mean, I think we have, you know, Lauren and I, we have our place in New York and we've loved being back there too. So I think we'll always go back and forth.
Okay, right. like the song a lot. Who is Leslie's winner for tomorrow?
Oh, my winner for tomorrow. I think Switzerland is fantastic, and he also has
yes.
a gorgeous artsy vibe.
Yes.
He's brilliant. He's definitely my top. And I love James Newman. He's become like a friend of mine online too.
The UK entry. UK. Yes,
yeah. Exactly.
I have neither of those on the cart wall here.
What do you have, France?
France. There you go. Quintessentially French, and for that reason probably won't win, I'd imagine.
She's pretty up there, and I think Italy's fairly up there too. I watched their performance in the rehearsals, and they were great. Now, I will say I did beat them in ping pong, so that's something for us to be proud about.
You beat these guys in ping pong?
I bet Italy in ping pong, so we have that.
Yeah, so it'll be them and up against Finland for the headbanging prize. And I love Iceland, you know, and it's so close to Ireland as well. Just change the R for a C or a C for an R. And will they get to perform now, or are they still in isolation?
Yeah, I think so. They played their rehearsal
yes.
last night. So hopefully, I think if they run another round of tests, which they do every 48 hours, we'll see if they get to perform.
Okay.
I hope they do. You know, I feel bad for the people, myself in this category too, who had to go through last year. So I do hope they get to perform
yeah.
tomorrow night.
And just on that rehearsal thing, you mentioned that you'd done rehearsals. So all the rehearsals were recorded. So, for example, if you had got COVID, they would have played out your rehearsal.
Exactly, yeah, right. They would have played one of the last rehearsals, yeah.
And how would you have felt about that? Because there wouldn't have been the mess up around the camera and all that.
Well, like I said, the mess up around the camera didn't cause us not to get through to the final. But if they played the rehearsal, they would. I think every artist had the worry of that happening. So we knew going into this that there could have been more of that than it's you know what
yes,
has happened.
Yes. So you did it as a performance as opposed to a rehearsal.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
We've got Switzerland. So this is your tip to win tomorrow night. It's on RTE, starts at 8 o'clock. It's a pity we won't be cheering on Leslie Roy with Maps. But anyway, you'll come into us and perform for us when you're home.
100%.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this is Switzerland. Thanks, Leslie. Thank you.
Thanks,
mind yourself.
Cheers.
See you. Bye. 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 Bye.
Bye.
So there you have it, Switzerland, one of the hot favourites to win the Eurovision tomorrow night. And you can watch all the coverage on RTE1 television from 8 o'clock. That's all we have time for on Playback Daily. We're back again at the same time on Monday. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and have a great weekend.